Shalom, Baruchim Habaim. Welcome. Welcome to Awakening Torah, Musar, Mindfulness. I'm Rabbi Chassia Uriel Steinbauer, the founder and director of the Institute for Holiness, Kehilat Musar, Mindfulness, where we integrate the ancient wisdoms of Musar in the Jewish tradition and the Dharma of mindfulness from Theravada Buddhism. I'm delighted that you've joined us. We look at the Torah portion, the Hebrew Bible, each Shabbat, each Sabbath, and see what we can learn from our ancestors and from God in order to assist us. And this year is particularly dedicated to us who are coping and trying to heal and recover and deal with and live with. First, the genocide of October 7th in Israel, the kidnappings and the ongoing captivity of over 100 people for over 100 days, the ongoing war and now wars in different locations. So this is really a time for us to see what we can learn from the Torah, from the tradition, to be able to apply in our own lives. So I'm delighted that you've joined us. Whether you're joining us live stream right now on our YouTube channel, please subscribe, or you're joining us on the blog on the website of kehilatmusar.com, both audio and video, or you may be watching this live on one of the social media networks, including Facebook. Welcome. Delighted to have you. So we always begin with our kavanot, our intentions for today's session. I'm going to go ahead and share screen with you if you are watching and have vision. Otherwise, I will read the kavanot, the intentions for today's practice, which is the same every day, every time we meet together once a week to engage in this awakening. And we hope to merit these, fulfill them. So we see this practice of Musar mindfulness as threefold. Radical self-care, caring for others, with others, bearing the burden with others, and our relationship with God, the divine Hashem, however you define that relationship or however you define the Almighty. So we see this time together, an awakening right now, this hour together, of an act of radical self-care so that we can strengthen our own souls. As we learn together and then practice mindfulness meditation, that we're doing this to really strengthen our own soul so we can be of benefit to others in the future. The second is that we're doing this on behalf of the ideal, the intention to strengthen our relationship to others so that we can be a better conduit of God's good to others when they need us. And the final intention, the final kavanah, is that we strengthen our relationship with the divine, that we want to be an excellent conduit of God's good. And so we do this learning and practice to begin to not only know God more, but to know what is wanted and expected of us and to live out the path. I'm going to stop sharing for those of you who are watching visually. Those of you by audio and podcast, you heard me read the intentions, the kavanot. So, what are we covering today? Obviously, yesterday on Shabbat, we covered the Torah portion Yitro, but we here at the Institute for Holiness are covering last week's Torah portion, Beshalach, and then we will cover Yitro, Bezrat Hashem, God willing, this week, probably tomorrow. So when did Beshalach happen? Hopefully you've read it and studied it and engaged in it. That is the fourth Torah portion and the book of Exodus, known as Shemot. So this happened on January 27th of this Gregorian year, 2024. The Hebrew calendar was Yud Zayin, the 17th, and the Hebrew month of Shvat in the Hebrew year of Tashen Pei Dalet, 5784. So I'm going to give a summary of the Torah portion, and then we're going to hone in on what I think we need in order to kind of strengthen one another in our practice. So God in this Torah portion leads the children of Israel, known as Bnei Israel, out of Mitzrayim, out of Egypt. They were in the institution of slavery, enslaved, and their cries and calling out to God. God comes and with an outstretched arm and a strong hand, it causes liberation of them. I say of their bodies, because to liberate oneself from slavery, one requires oneself, but also time, a lot of time and practice. So Paro and his army, the Pharaoh of Egypt, actually chased the children of Israel. Here they kicked them out and they wanted them gone after the 10th plague of God killing the firstborn of every Egyptian and even animals. It's like Paro woke up and was like, wait a minute, I had slaves. They were mine. I owned their property. I had this labor, this free, almost free labor. Obviously, you have to feed a slave, house it, and so forth. But it's definitely cheaper and different than hiring someone, right? So they chase B'nai Israel and they trap them by what we call Yam Suf, the Sea of Reeds. And Moshe is basically commanded by God to raise his staff, and God miraculously splits the sea into two. This is one of the most famous known stories and scenes in Western culture, is this, where Moshe is holding out the staff and the God causes the seas to split, right? So B'nai Israel are able to cross through the sea on the dry land in between the two walls of water on either side. Pharaoh, known as Paro in Hebrew, and his army chase after them. And it's only when B'nai Israel get on the other side, the waters then are let go with all the wrath, that they return to normal level by drowning the Egyptians. Okay? We don't say drowning Paro because it's actually not confirmed, and there's lots of Midrashim and stories that he survived. That's for another time. So Moshe, Miriam, and B'nai Israel actually sing songs of gratitude when they get to the other side. They're so grateful that they survived, that they were able to escape the terror of this terrorist army chasing after them. With Paro. Then they head on after crossing over. They have to start their journey wherever God tells them to go. And B'nai Israel arrive at a place we call Mara. And there the water, which they needed at that time to drink, it's too bitter to drink. And God tells Moshe, you know, they complain a little bit. Obviously, when you're thirsty and the water's bitter, you're going to complain. They complain, and God shows Moshe a branch to throw into the water to sweeten it. And later, basically, Moshe is commanded to provide B'nai Israel, the children of Israel, with more water by hitting a rock. So then we go through a cycle of what we might call crises in the wilderness. Okay, so what happens next is the children of Israel complain that they don't have enough food, which is probably also true. And then God rains down something called man. And I believe in English you call it manna. So the man comes from the sky. And on Friday, they are to collect a double portion, two of them, since no man will fall on Shabbat, which is Saturday. This is already beginning to train B'nai Israel, the children of Israel, and how one practices and lives the Sabbath, the Shabbat. So they're already in an embodied live experience of collecting double, doing double, preparing on Friday before the Sabbath, in order to have a certain experience of keeping and observing Shabbat. So we'll just keep that in the back of our minds. Finally, at the end of this Torah portion, Amalek, who is considered a people who dwell up in the mountains at the time, they actually come down and attack the children of Israel as they're on their journey out of slavery.
And Moshe stands over the battle with his special staff. And on either side, because he's too weak to hold his staff the whole time, Aharon, his older brother, is holding one arm, and Hor is helping him by the other, because they find that if they hold his hands up, then the children of Israel can actually start winning that battle. If his hands go down, then they start losing the battle. And so there's something going on here, what we call a performative act. Again, another really embodied experience. So you have to ask yourself, which we'll get to, what does one learn? What does one gain over time and with through that actual communal experience that one, the leader had to have his arms held up by two other people from the community in order for the rest of the community to fight and win. So there's something really strong and important here that we want to keep in mind, that this is all practice and training of these people, and there's something there for us to learn. Okay, so they hold his hands up all day long, and Yehoshua leads the Israelite army, and they end up being victorious. Okay, so that is a summary of the Torah portion. What is it that I want to cover here that I think is important? This is our 16th sitting together. We went through the book of Genesis, of Bereshit, and now we're in Shemot, which is Exodus. And I want to make sure that you know where we are, where I want to start leading you. If you're following along, we are in chapter 13 in Exodus, starting with Pasuk verse 17. That's where Beshalach starts, known as the Exodus. That goes on to 1431. And then we have it, within that we have the miracle at the sea in chapter 14. And then we have the beautiful Shirat HaYam, the song at the sea, showing the great gratitude of everyone for crossing safely and not having the terror army of Pharaoh following after them. And then we get into what is called the crises in the wilderness, where there's a lack of water, there's a lack of food, and there's the people's reactivity to that, and then there's Moses's reactivity to that, and then God's response and sometimes reactivity. That's chapter 15, verse 22 through chapter 17, verse 16. So we have a lot of experiences there and stories that you can read and follow. And then finally ending with the battle of Amalek, which comes at the end. Okay, so I want to begin with I have my notes here. Okay, so the first thing that we need to realize when reading this text, it starts with the language, right? Vayhi b'shalach paro et ha'am velo nacham elokim derech eretz plishtim ki karov hu ki amar elokim pein yichanachem ha'am birotam milchama v'shavu mitzrayma. Okay, so Paro, when Paro, it gets translated when people Paro let the people go, but Bishalach means in the shalach, in the sending away, which back in ancient Middle East, Middle Eastern understanding carries the double judicial sense of divorce. When somebody shalach somebody, in this case, it's always a husband sending a wife away. This is Paro sending Bnei Israel away, okay? Sending away in the divorce sense and also the emancipation of a slave. So in this moment of Paro sending away the people, God then decides not to send them, lead them, I should say, to lead them by the way of the Philistines, although that's actually closer. That would be going up the west coast of Egypt, actually through the Gaza, through Gaza, what we modern day Gaza in English. That would be the quickest and easiest route into the land of Canaan, of what will be the state of Israel, not in Medinat Israel, the state today, but the kingdom and living in the land. So I want to just start with the concept that we need to keep in mind in this ongoing war with Palestinian terrorists and Palestinian supporters of terrorists, that there needs to be a judicial sense of shalach, of shlichut, of divorce, and emancipation from the violence of them against us and what they feel and perceive as violence from us. There has to be eventually this outcome, whatever it might look like. It might be like Bosnia, where there have to be an international body that comes in to manage and monitor things, and then demilitarized zone. Maybe that will be the outcome of the area that we call Aza and Gaza in English. So just to really learn from this model and this understanding of historically what needs to happen when two peoples really need to separate, because one is, in this case, the Egyptians were enslaving our ancestors, the Hebrews, the children of Israel. For us, we need that separation from the Gazans, from the Palestinians and the Palestinian terrorists, because constant violence, obviously the genocide of October 7th, the sending over of missiles, this is not a people we want to be in relationship with. There has to be that form of divorce. And so... And I feel probably from their perspective, as I've listened to and learned from particularly Palestinians living abroad, this is the same thing that they are going to need and want also eventually. Okay, so we start with that. What I have to say about this is what you're going to notice in this Exodus story and even going into the Bamidbar and the wilderness. I don't translate it as desert because it's really a wilderness. That you can have a purpose, right? An intention, a purpose. And then there are consequences, right? And a lot of times for us human beings, especially we'll see with our ancestors in the stories, we're not in control always of the consequences. We can set out with an intention and a path and a purpose, but it's really beyond our control. We can try to anticipate, we can try to know. And so we often just have to accept that we're going to have unclean hands. And in this case, we're obviously having blood on our hands, all of us. We have to live with this. We have to live as responsibly as we can towards the long term. And so you need to understand in this biblical model in the ancient Near East for our ancestors, when there is the wicked, as we feel the Hamas terrorists and their supporters were, in the biblical model, it has to be the full destruction of the wicked. And that's the only way that moral order, say there, right, is reestablished. The two cannot exist. If you have a wicked evil behavior, you cannot have moral order, right? And people even feel that inside, like where's my moral compass? Where's the trust in the fabric of society holding us, right? So there's this real sense, even today here in Israel, where there's a sense of that Hamas and its supporters there needs to be destruction. There needs to be no more of them as terrorists. They cannot be, and they certainly cannot be held in power. And that's the only way to establish this moral order. So what happens in this story here in the Exodus and Beshalach is in chapter 14, verse 10, it teaches us, let me get to the actual text for you. It says, as Paro drew near, the Israelites caught sight of the Egyptians advancing upon them. Now, if you look at the language here, it says, Mitzrayim nosea achareichem. It is the singular verb that Egypt is traveling, advancing upon them. And that doesn't make sense grammatically, but also it's there for a reason. The language is very important in the Torah and the Hebrew Bible. So when the Egyptians are advancing, it's this singular verb in order to show they were of one mind. They acted in concert, really attempting to cause genocide, mass destruction of Bnei Israel, of our ancestors of the Hebrew. And so when people act like this, then in the biblical and ancient Near East model, they are deserving of mass destruction. And it really of a death-obsessed religion and people, to be honest with you. And that brings up a lot of feelings and similarities today. And then we have to be very careful with how we analyze and see clearly and not fall into one, are really all the Gazans and all the Palestinians acting of one mind, where they want to cause genocide to the Jewish people. I think we're still figuring that out. It definitely feels that way. When there are polls done, I think it shows 80% want this. So obviously, no poll was taken of the Egyptians. We can only tell by their behavior. So this is why it's going to be so important when we move into the phase finally of after our troops leave Gaza and the international community involves itself with managing that land space and the people. Is there really of one mind deserving of mass destruction, or is there a way and an outlet and a place to have a people that will try to better themselves and eventually manage themselves, right? This is very important that we, although our ancestors have passed down these stories and models to us, we want to be very clear that we just don't generalize completely. They can give us inspiration, but this is what we're facing right here and right now. The other thing that's really, really intense in the story, and this is coming on chapter 14, verse 23, is when the Egyptians came in pursuit after the children of Israel at the sea, right? They came with this kind of deranged, brutal obstinacy. There was a real stuckness, stubbornness, right? And that happens to people who are acting obviously with reactivity, with greed, hatred, delusion. And that's what we saw obviously on October 7th and the genocide in Israel, just Palestinian supporters and Palestinian terrorists just coming in with what we call this deranged, brutal obstinacy. What happens to the Egyptians is essentially they all lead, this leads to their own death, this behavior. They're plunged into the waters from God. So what comes out of this experience of our ancestors witnessing God saving them and the Egyptians being plunged into the waters is this real emunah, this real faith. Now, to understand faith in the Jewish system and from our ancestors, it's not belief-based. Faith is a cultivation and internalization of trust and loyalty that really leads to behavior that is obedient and committed. It has to be reflected not only in a trust or a loyalty, a feeling inside per se, but more essentially that it shows itself, it manifests as behavior, okay? It's very important. So if we go to chapter 14:31, I wanted to take you through this. That's where they say that they had faith. Okay. Now, life changes, conditions change, circumstances do, and they can really affect us. We might think that we're resourced and practice and feel that we can pivot and know how to
manage and deal with things, but then conditions change. And this is the gift that's given to us in this Torah portion, is that our ancestors, the Hebrews, the children of Israel, went from an ultimate height in emunah, in faith, really obedient and committed to God, following God in the middle of the wilderness, based on the experience of experiencing a miracle. But we all know that miracles do not last as long-term impetus and for practice and for transformation. They might be a height experience, but that does not reach us in the mundane musar work of the day-to-day work and practice to transform long-term, right? So this is what we witness. Essentially, the people's faith, meaning their obedience and commitment, right, their trust and loyalty, gets weakened by the strains of life and their own reactivity to those conditions, okay? And this is what is aptly called the crises in the wilderness. So moving to chapter 15, verse 22 through chapter 17, verse 16. What do we notice there? We noticed the people behaving in a very timid way from time to time. There's a lot of skepticism, which is doubt, which is one of the most difficult hindrances to get stuck in, right? There's a lot of unwise reactivity and thinking, a lot of narrative and storytelling that's not based necessarily on the reality on the ground, okay? So by chapter 15, verse 24, the people, and that's the language used, you want to be very careful here looking at the language. It says here, Vayil nu ha'am al Moshe lemor, ma'nishte, right? Okay, so the people, ha'am, the people grumble against Moshe, saying, what shall we drink? What are we going to drink? We're thirsty. This is crazy, right? So there's the condition itself. There's the stimuli. There's a lack of water. Then there could be a response with the space between the match and the fuse. Okay, we don't have so much water. Let's work as a team and resource and divvy it up and give it to most in need and make sure everyone has at least a little till we get to the next place. That can be a response. We don't witness that, right? What we witness instead is a grumbling, a passivity, which is what else could a slave really, what's skill set could a slave really have at this point, where they their whole lives have been told what to do, been given the food they're going to eat, been given the drink they're going to drink, been given the living quarters they're going to live in. Excuse me. Been given everything. So there's a big, when one is enslaved, there's a big passivity in the sense that the masters, the owners, they control everything and provide it if and when they're going to. So it makes total sense that the people are going to be in the desert and they're going to be like, where is water, right? And how do we live with this lack of water? It's turning again to master in the sense of like thinking it's going to be fixed or provided by one person, in this case Moshe, via God. So the reactivity then comes as fear, doubt, a real sense of turning it into a narrative of, oh my God, there's no water, I'm going to die. And that's the second error, right? The condition itself is there's the lack of water. The second is the reactivity to that. Okay, so it's just, it makes the situation worse than what it potentially is or could have been. So that's the start of this journey, right? They have these bitter waters at a place called Marah, and they complain. Then it shifts, okay? Then they move to a shortage of food in chapter 16, where Hashem provides man. What happens in chapter 16,
verse 2 is you look at the change in the language. It says here, in the wilderness, right, in the Bamidbar, Kol Adat B'nai Yisrael Al Moshe, what did they do here? And it's the same verb, interesting enough, without the vowels here, which is most likely Vayin Lohu. No, here it's saying Vayilinu. Okay. This real grumbling, but it's changed from Ha'am to Kol Adat B'nai Yisrael. So the whole Israelite community now is grumbling to Moshe and Aharon, both of them, not just Moshe now. And the grumbling is not just, what shall we drink? It's one thing. What shall we drink? It turns to, if only we had died, hand of the Lord, in the land of Egypt, we sat by the flesh pots, we ate our full of bread, storytelling, narrative, right? This is total storytelling. For you've brought us out into this wilderness to starve this whole congregation, right? Kol ha-kachal hazeh, from starvation, right? They're gonna end up in death. Whoa, no space between the match and the fuse there, right? Okay, again, what could have been the response to we're lacking in food? There's a food shortage. We're starting to feel really hungry. What could have been a response? An appropriate response, one that really brings out the best in everyone, where they could have somehow worked and managed to figure it out and maybe even beseeched, right? We're hungry. Can you help, please? Can you do this? Instead, it goes all the way here to full reactivity to not only the whole community now is this. It's not just Ha'am, it's Kol Hadat B'nai Yisrael. And they move immediately into, if only we should have been back there, we should still be in slavery, better to be enslaved and to have what we think is food over there than to be going through this difficult, uncomfortable moment right now. Okay. I say this with a smile and sense of humor only because I recognize this so well. How many of us, not God forbid anyone's enslaved and gone through this, but how much in our own lives did we, like, it could have been a lack of water, it could have been a lack of food, it could have just been when we're children, we didn't get the toy we wanted, we didn't get to go on the play date we wanted, we didn't get to go outside, whatever it may be. As adults, we didn't get to the call that we wanted, the train already left, another bill has arrived, all sorts of things that arise, right? That come up that are unwanted, are unpleasant, are unsatisfactory in life. What we call dukkha in the Dharma, right? Dukkha is also known as suffering. But suffering in English has this connotation that it's something really, really bad, like pain and suffering, almost like you're being beaten. Really, it encompasses this whole. It's lately in modern Western secular practice of Buddhism, really being translated lately as that which is just unwanted, that is stressful, it's stress, that you're put under strain. So this real sense that they are experiencing, B'nai Israel, the children, are experiencing dukkha, this real unwantedness, right? They don't want to be hungry. They don't want to be thirsty. Right. And in that reactivity towards it, right, that's only going to fuel the fire. Instead of being like recognizing, oh, this is uncomfortable. This is feels a little painful. There's some suffering here in response to this lack of food and water. And how can I respond in the most appropriate, wise way? That's not happening. And partly that's not happening because we're dealing with recently released slaves. Slaves don't have this resourcing and skills. They just don't. You might have like one or two people in there that might have some of those skills. Maybe they were what we call like, what's the terminology that was brought to the Americas? The house slave versus the field slave. So maybe the house slave in this case has a little bit more skills and resources to pivot. Definitely Moshe should have, right? Moses should have had more skills, ideally being raised in a palace. And then having the freedom to flee to Midian and get married and form a family. So I don't know. We have to see. We have to see if, have compassion, and understanding towards our ancestors, that this is what they're going through. I'm going to keep moving on. Okay. So basically, we see what has to happen to a people when they're full of reactivity. They need to pull themselves out of the storytelling and the narrative to see clearly what's going on, right? And to be able to respond. And I have to say, it gives me great courage and hope, and I hope it does you too, when we see two things happening. One, we see some of the Gazans, some of the people who are residing in Gaza, as protesting against Hamas and saying, you cannot behave this way, release the hostages, then, you'll engage in a ceasefire. You must stop this behavior, essentially, to Hamas. That is a form of seeing clearly. That is a form of wise response in probably deep conditions of dukkha, that could bring a lot of reactivity. But instead, you're seeing some wise response. The same thing is happening among some of the families here in Israel, particularly those who have family members who are still being held as captives, as hostages in Gaza and Gaza, and even their supporters, and even some of the soldiers who are off of serving for right now. They have strategized into really wonderful, appropriate responses to these conditions, to this dukkha, to this unpleasant, unwanted situation, where they are choosing to be stopping the food and resources from going in because Hamas steals that food from the Gazans. And the men, no change happens. We give them food, we give them resources, and they don't release the hostages. So you finally have you have groups of people who are seeing clearly and are responding appropriately in order to cause the conditions to have Hamas release the hostages and to allow for a ceasefire. Then we can't engage in a ceasefire without releasing the hostages, obviously. So these are really tough conditions for our ancestors. Our beloved teacher Nachama Lebowitz likes to say that God took them through the more long, difficult way instead of taking them up the way of the Philistines, the Plishtim, is because the tough conditions needed to harden them, right? To teach them endurance and heroism. My only problem with that commentary, and trust me, I love Nachama. I consider her one of my teachers. May her memory be for a blessing. If that's the case, then why did that generation 40 years later have all of them have to die in the desert by then? There's only two responses to Nachama that we could have from that. Either the tough conditions were not sufficient enough to really serve to harden our ancestors, to teach them endurance and heroism, or it just didn't work, right? And so I don't really buy that argument so much. But there is this real understanding that it'll take a whole new generation that will go through the rest of this Exodus, in the Exodus story, and even into Vayikra, Leviticus, and Bamidbar, and in the wilderness, and Devarim, and Deuteronomy, the book of Deuteronomy, these three coming up books, that one, two, three, yes, that only a new generation will need to be born in the deserts, not in exile, not in slavery, that would have the conditions and experience necessary for back to Emunah, back to for the trust and loyalty, back to the obedience and commitment to enter the land, right? So that's going to be the same for us here in Israel and the people in Gaza. It really is. We'll of course all practice and do our best, but I really believe it's going to be the next generation
and even our grandchildren, Bezrat Hashem, God willing, who will have the resources and the conditions for them to manage this in such a way that we could potentially live nation next to nation without violence, without war. So we'll see. Let's keep moving on. So just back to the thing, remember when I said miracles are not sufficient? Fear and love of God, right? And when I say fear, I mean reverence. This yirah, which means both fear and reverence together, right? This it doesn't exist in English, a word like this. But this reverence and fear and love of God have to be earned through the mundane, daily, often repetitive and sometimes boring daily practice in life. It's not something that can just, it's there by witnessing or seeing a miracle. It's shown over and over again that the miracles don't sustain any emunah, any faith, and any long-term transformation for the people to be in a regular brit covenant and relationship with God that it doesn't flip on a dime, doesn't flip with changing conditions, doesn't neither side abandoning one another based on changing conditions and the reactivity, the dukkha and the reactivity to the dukkha, that the suffering that's coming up. This is going to be very important to us when we move into our mindfulness meditation today. So I have something very profound to finally close with and share from this Torah portion. It's hard for me. I'm very much tied to our ancestors, and I feel them, and I feel for them, and I learn a lot from them, and I hope you do too. Okay, so I'm going to remind you, let's have compassion and understanding for Moshe, but we're going to see a real, his own dukkha, his own reactivity to his own storytelling, his lack of faith towards the people. Okay, this is really going to turn out to be quite foundational through their time in the desert and why he actually doesn't enter the promised land. Okay. It's not about hitting the rock in his anger. We're gonna see this and build this all the way through. So what happens? Go back to when Moshe is standing before the bush that's burning but not consumed. It's a correct translation of the Hebrew. Basically, when he's being called and commanded to lead the people with God's help out of Egypt, okay, out of slavery. His response was, "No way are these people going to believe me, of like who you are and what I've been sent to do." God doesn't take very kindly to this, right? Neither does the tradition, our commentators, our parshanim. This real sense of they see it as slander towards the people, not giving them a benefit of the doubt, claiming they're going to the whole people. Kol ha'am, kol ha'dat b'nei Israel, both are not going to believe him or follow him. And that it really, there's a sense of almost disappointment from God, right? There's a sense that you have to go, Moshe, and be with them and experience them to learn that they do have emunah. Yes, is it really tried and really difficult conditions? And are they in the slave mindset? Yes, and they will be throughout the 40 years. But it was a very difficult moment for God and our ancestors, our commentators, our sages to see, hear Moshe say, they're not going to believe me. This act of slander, essentially, right? So what happens here? The same thing happens here. I just want to see. Yeah, he's very judgmental towards the people. It's not wise discernment, it's judgment. We want to learn from this. We want to pay very close attention to our use of language, of what we call people, if we're having judgment towards them versus wise discernment.
So we have a lot to learn here. So what happens with Moshe? Come follow me to chapter 17, 1 through 4, I believe this comes. Let's see here. Okay, so this is another scene where the people are this actually might just be a reminder. Okay, the people are thirsty again, which if you follow Abravanel, wonderful commentator, I believe from Spain, 15th century, he says, this is actually not a lack of faith in God when the people grumble for food and water. Like, that's a real legitimate need. And he doesn't have a problem with it. He doesn't judge it, okay? But Moshe, Moses, our beloved prophet and leader, has a lot of reactivity to their grumbling. And on one hand, I don't blame him. It's really hard to be one leader of millions of people who are former slaves, right? In the middle of the desert. This is a boy who was pampered, raised in the palace of Paro, of the Egyptian pharaoh. This is someone who, in some ways, hasn't faced the consequences of his own behavior of murdering an Egyptian. He fled to, and I don't want to call it murder. Someone corrected me with the language. He killed an Egyptian who was about to kill, in the process of killing a Hebrew slave. So he intervened to stop that murder, and he killed the Egyptian. Okay, but there's still blood on his hands. He's still killed, and he fled. Okay, he fled. This is someone who was raised a certain way and then fled, facing what was possibly going to happen with that. And so he has his own reactivity, perhaps because of that upbringing, right? When something's being demanded of him, that's going to cause him to be uncomfortable, unsure of himself, unwanted. This is another form of dukkha. He finds this unsatisfactory, unpleasant, to have to lead these people and everything associated with it. He tried to be very clear to God about it. I'm not the one, right? That's going to be another thing we'll explore, is why God didn't listen to him. We might argue that, okay, he could have been trained through the practice and the trials over time, but to not listen to Moshe's voice has its own consequences, okay? So what happens here in chapter 17, the people say, give us water. And Moshe says, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you try God? So already he moves from just them coming and complaining about a lack of water is quarreling with him. See the narrative and the storytelling? Why do you try the Lord? He's escalated the storytelling. Okay. And it says the people thirsted there for water and the people grumbled. And then they go on, why didn't you bring us back to Egypt? You know, why did you bring us up from Egypt to basically kill us and our children? So then they go, notice the cycle of reactivity, caught in the suffering, right? Without a wise response, okay? What does he do? He then turns to Abba, Hashem, God, cries out to him and says, what shall I do with his people? This is in Pasuk verse 4. Before long, they will be stoning me. Are you having the response I'm having? What? Before long, they will be stoning me. Wait, ever did these people threaten violence to Moshe Rabbeinu? Okay, we see no evidence of that. He's having a lot of reactivity and storytelling. He's having dukkha. He's having his own prediction of suffering around this. So he's having... And then the storytelling that gets so escalated that he now says this. This is really intense. This ends up marking for our Parshanim, our ancestors, our sages, that he does not have faith in the people. There's not a trust and a loyalty. There's not a commitment and a sense of like submitting to an obedience in the sense of really submitting to his role and purpose. It comes to us in... essentially, from, I believe it comes from Midrash. I want to see what else I want to share with you here. We have to be very careful I'll come out of this once I deal with the Midrash. So in Midrash Tanhuma in Bishalach number 22, they come to teach us, our ancestors, that God is actually quite upset at Moshe. He even says later on, I mean, right in response to this, God responds with compassion and understanding towards the people, and orders, basically commands Moshe in verse 5, right? Avor lifnei ha'am, pass before the people, right? Pass before the people. It goes on to say, then take with you some of the elders and your rod to strike this, and you'll get water, essentially. Okay, so pass before the people. So all of a sudden, our ancestors, our commentators come and say, what? Why this? Why pass before the people? Why is this need here, right? So this is really intense, because God is trying to show Moshe that it's all narrative and storytelling in his head, in his judgment. He passed before the people, and not one person is raising a stone to stone him, right? He has to face that fear. He has to walk in front of and past the people, get out of his reactivity, right? And maybe begin to see their suffering, that they're thirsty, and that the leader needs to pass before and be among the people to be with them in their suffering. Yes, I know it's hard. We don't have water yet, right? This is a total rebuke to Moshe for his judgment, and again, slander. Slander that these people are going to stone him. And this is really intense, because what is this teaching us? We need to be so careful with our own language, right? And what it's in what's so clear about his language, he says here, what shall I do with this people? Okay, le'am hazeh. He doesn't say my people as he did before. He says, this people. He's emotionally and physically distanced himself from them. There's this real sense that we have to be very careful, not only with our thoughts, but how it gets translated into speech, of how we see one another. This is going to be very important for us here in Israel and all of Am Yisrael, all the Jewish people throughout the whole world, of how we speak to one another, how we see one another, to see clearly, and in what narrative, what storytelling we tell one another. And about each other, we have to unify. We have to pass before each other, right? Giving the benefit of the doubt, really seeing each other's suffering and not reacting to it, and not having judgment based on the suffering that we're going through, as if we either shouldn't, or it should be different or less. So we want to be very, very, this is part of our practice. This is what we're going to have to be working on. Well, forever, but especially right now. So this is what I feel like this Torah portion comes to teach us, that Moshe just got into this pattern of ordering the people about, right? And Moshe, and God's coming in this in Midrash Tanhuma to say, stop ordering these people about and lead them like the shepherd. Lead them like the shepherd that you are, and how I found you and called you to purpose. That you were leading sheep back then, and this is one of the reasons why I selected you, Moshe, right? And then it goes on, the Midrash goes on to teach us, it was only for these people's sake, right? That Moshe, I brought you out of Egypt. That's intense. What he's actually saying, God is saying to Moshe in this moment, is I'm laying before you your purpose. This is why you are here, right here and right now, with this service. This is the only reason, is for the sake of these people. And you will be with them and get through this. And when you have fulfilled that purpose for the sake of this particular people, who are former slaves, when that generation dies out, you too will also die. This is where we get a window in why Moshe dies with them, why Moshe does not enter the promised land, because his full purpose is for the sake of this people, to bring them out of Egypt. Once he's fulfilled that purpose, that is it. He's answered his calling. And this is very important, okay? And even God says, you will go to find favor and grace and life and honor before me. And even then, by fulfilling this purpose, don't try to be anything else or other. Don't try to distance yourself. Don't try to order them about. Be a shepherd. This is going to be so important to how we treat each other with gentleness and kindness and compassion and understanding. How we carry one another through this Shoah, this Holocaust, this genocide, and the kidnapping, the captives, and this war, and the multiple wars, essentially crimes against humanity, right? And this whole kind of war of civilizations, it's probably going to go on, God forbid, for years, if not decades. This is so important that we be able to carry one another and be a shepherd to one another. So I leave you with that. I will close by saying, that I think it's no mistake that our Torah portion closes with the story of Amalek, essentially terrorists who come down the mountainside to actually kill the most vulnerable first, the children, the women with the children, the elderly, the disabled, who are in the back of Bnei Israel, taking longer to trek through the desert. They come down causing terror, violence, murder, attempt to genocide of the Hebrews, of the Bnei Israel. And this, I feel like, is the ultimate, what's the word I'm looking for? Moshe lacked faith, trust and loyalty, obedience and commitment to this people, and was projecting onto the people that they don't have it for God simply because they're complaining about food and water. And he had to go through, this is another form of passing before the people. He had to actually go through an experience, a very awful, traumatic one, where in order to survive and win this battle, he required the assistance of other people. He required the assistance of Aharon on one side and Hor on the other, and the people with Yehoshua out there actually fighting. And the minute his arms were let down, Aharon Hor did not hold them up, we began to lose that battle. And they realized this, and they worked as a team and held each other up. And Moshe should have been, and God willing, even them, really profoundly affected by this experience, hopefully with eyes wide open to see and analyze what went on and why they were successful in this battle in the end. Again, it might not last like miracles don't last, what we actually learn or experience from them, because it takes ongoing practice over time, daily, in community, on this path of Musar mindfulness. So we'll see how it unfolds, what happens next. When we move into Parshat Yitro, which is my favorite, coming up soon, which we just covered. So I just want to conclude as we move into our mindfulness meditation practice, that what is our chiyuv? What is obligated of us, especially as Jews, but even all our allies and non-Jewish supporters, right? What is it that we're supposed to learn from this? What are we doing here together? So we have a few as a Jewish people, and I think lots of people can learn from us from this, not to only see the broken shards, not to only see what is awful, right? Not to only see the dukkha, the suffering. We are obligated not to do that. We are obligated to also see how we can support and the beauty and the joy and the wonderfulness together, right? How we can pivot. And so the same too, we have to make sure our desires, not only our desires, but our reactivity to conditions don't blind us. That's a very important thing that we have to really check in. Am I seeing clearly? Is this an appropriate response, right? Am I speaking with kindness? Am I bringing compassion and understanding? So we have to be aware of our strengths to overcome this Yetzahara, which gets translated as the evil inclination in the Musar tradition, but really it's just this negative impulse, right? The reactivity, right? I'm gonna create a whole narrative and story in my head that isn't true. So we need to make the effort to feel the suffering of our brethren, of others, right? Moshe didn't do that. He didn't make an effort to feel and know their suffering from lacking water and food. He instead just had judgment and fear and storytelling. So that's very important that we attempt to do that. You can only do this through ongoing practice of this path of taking refuge in Musar mindfulness, of mastering our thoughts, right? That will truly experience freedom in our life, a form of liberation, to be able to see clearly. And this happens with intention, with kavanah. Happens in a vad, a Musar vad together, a group that practices together with a master teacher and a path and a chavruta, a learning partner. And so what happens with our ancestors? What is going to be their path that eventually will help them? It's going to be the mitzvot, the commandments over time that they start learning. God starts instructing them. This is how your practice is going to be. This is what you're going to be doing on a daily basis. You're going to be doing avodah, service in the Mishkan and all life surrounding it, and all the different mitzvot, the commandments surrounding it. And this is going to mold you and your character over time. And we are the privileged inheritors of the mitzvot, of the whole system. That not only do we have that to guide us as an Am, as a people in our nation, and now our beautiful ancestors over the past, well, the whole tradition has been around for at least 1,000 years, but the actual modern Musar movement came to us 18th century, really started solidifying by the 19th, in order to even enhance our observance of the mitzvot, to say, we need to work on our midot, building our interior world, as Rav Shlomo Walby teaches. This is going to strengthen us even in more profound, powerful ways than what the skill set of our ancestors, of just the mitzvot. Right? That this is so profound, and it's such a gift to us that we've inherited this tradition, and that it's such a privilege and honor for me to have inherited it, to be able to pass on to you and to teach you and to practice and learn together, that we can now really move towards a form of freedom by really mastering our thoughts, right? It's really about, and all this has been shown in brain-based research today in neuroscience, right? Training the mind is really training the soul and the heart to be on this path, to be able to give God's good to others. So no person feels free. If they don't feel free with the storytelling that they have, even if they are in the body, right? Say they're not enslaved. Someone doesn't feel free, they're not going to be free, right? So with that, we're going to celebrate our own gift. We're going to move into a sitting together. So please assume your posture. Come to the edge of the seat if you're seated. If you need to be standing or walking or lying down, please do that. I will guide you through this meditation and ring the bells when we are done. So assuming your posture, again, you want it upright, dignified, created in the image and likeness of the divine. Excuse me. For those of you listening by audio, I have to take a drink of water. Please do so also for yourself. You want to feel really weighted in your sit bones so that you feel really grounded and held. That's Hashem's way of holding you, God's way of letting you know you're held in this moment. And we're going to close the eyes if you have vision and if you feel safe and comfortable. Otherwise, lower your vision before you and take a deep inhalation and exhale. And then again, inhalation, exhale. You feel the shoulders drop? Quite beautiful. This again, inhalation, the gift of oxygen from God. And exhale. Check in with yourself as you would a best friend. What is your mood? What is your current state with your emotions? What is arising, if anything? What are your thoughts? Are you having lots of them? Are they jumping all around? Or are they calm? You're able to kind of observe them, witness them, and they just pass like dew in the morning sun. Notice any response or reactivity to any strong sensations in the body. Really giving yourself a loving, gentle, curious body scan, moving from your feet up, all through your legs, into the sit bones, up the beautiful erect spine, not West Point stiff. As our teacher, Jon Kabat-Zinn, reminds us, we want to be relaxed and at ease and still sitting in a dignified posture. An oxymoron seems contradictory, but it's not. Go ahead and practice it. So as long as we are grasping, holding on, identifying with something, we can turn any experience, even the best possible experience, into a form of dukkha, a form of the unwanted, of stress, of that which is painful, what we call dukkha, suffering. You probably have had a life experience with this. I know I have. Right? You're at the perfect setting. It's wonderful water and food. Everything's provided to you. And somehow you're still miserable. Right? It's just having so much reactivity. It's all internal. It's all in the heart and mind. You may have even had then judgment and reactivity towards yourself for having that reactivity. That's the third arrow. Right? I'm such a bad person that I'm so miserable right now, even though it's a lovely time. So that's the narrative. And that's what will end up happening in the desert, is we'll see as we move on past Yitro, past the Aseret HaDibrot, the 10 utterances, the 10 commandments, as it's known in the Western tradition, is not only where there'll be the stimuli that's somewhat challenging. For some, it'll be suffering, dukkha. But then there's the reactivity to whatever the challenges are and the crises in the wilderness. And then there'll be the judgment of that reactivity coming, a real moral one. That's judgment coming from Moshe, from God, and I'm sure internally. So it's really up to us to look at the suffering in our lives and look at our response or reactivity to it. That which is hard to bear, that which is stressful or under strain, right? And that's because we want things to be different than what they are. There's a craving, it's repetitive, it wallows in an attachment to the way things should be. What we want them to be. There's a greed. There's an indulgence. This chain of emotional reactivity leads to further suffering. So really, as part of what we call the Four Noble Truths, which generally has been translated as the Four Noble Tasks, is one is just recognizing that there's suffering in life. There's the unwanted, there's the strain and stress. And the second is what? How we confront it, how we recognize it, right? Can we transform our reactivity to suffering? And when we can't, when we get into a repetitive, self-preoccupied reactivity, it not only prevents us from responding appropriately to the situation at hand, but it actually reinforces and intensifies the suffering as well. So what is the practice, which sounds 10 times more easy than the practice itself? It's letting go of the grasping, the wanting things to be different than what they are. We don't want our craving for things to be different than what they are to determine how we respond to life. Which leads us to the third noble task, which there is a teaching of the cessation, being able to stop the suffering, being able to stop the reactivity. It holds that if our wanting things to be different than what they are actually causes the suffering and stress, then the sensation of us wanting things to be different must cause the cessation of dukkha, suffering. So dukkha really describes a whole spectrum of human distress, from the small flickers of disease to great losses and pain like we're experiencing now after the genocide of October 7th and for our captives and the ongoing war. Some of this dukkha, this suffering, is woven into the fabric of human life. None of us are exempt from aging, illness, or death, or even loss or unwelcome change. But when Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, from the teachings of the Buddha, speaks of the sensation of the stopping of dukkha, he speaks of the stopping of arguments we have with that which is inarguable. We can't argue that we're going to get sick and die someday. We can't argue that we're all age if we, God willing, live that long. We can't argue against that loss will come and unwelcome change. These are just woven in to be human, right? Our layers of reactivity, the confusion, the denial, the fear that we layer upon these core human vulnerabilities. My beloved teacher, Christina Feldman, a teacher of the Dharma, of Buddhism, she really loves to translate dukkha as vulnerability. When we react to just being vulnerable as a human being, this only compounds our distress. So as we witnessed with our ancestors in the desert, in the wilderness so far, facing the conditions of a lack of water and food, that's its own form of the fabric of human life, of walking through a wilderness, part of it a desert. But when it starts to lead to confusion and reactivity and denial and fear and then storytelling, that just compounds the distress. It doesn't help then when you then have the leader have the reactivity to his sheep. He's the shepherd. When he has his reactivity to the children of Israel, B'nai Israel, and Moshe does, it just compounds the distress. So we need to look at this in our own practice in life. We have lots of people around us who are really full of unwelcome change, of loss. Some of it built into the fabric of life, some of it totally not, just caused awfully by other humans, by Palestinian terrorists and their supporters. But we have to be very careful, because many of us will have a lot of reactivity, confusion, denial, fear, and this just compounds the distress. And then some of us will have judgment towards the people having that reactivity. Instead, we need to practice, come to awareness that we are having that reactivity, practice that self-restraint, and try to pivot. Try to pivot towards rachamim, compassion, towards emunah, faith that is full of trust and loyalty, of commitment, turning away from the reactivity, facing the human vulnerability with eyes wide open, with seeing clearly, with chesed, with loving kindness towards one another. So just as there is an origin to our suffering, there is a path that leads to the managing of the suffering and for some people an actual end. And in Buddhism, this is the Eightfold Path. And for our ancestors, it was the system of mitzvot, of commandments that we've lovingly inherited, that cultivating those mitzvot and living by them as an Am, as a people, really can face the vulnerabilities of human life and to end the reactivity and the suffering. For those on the path of the Dharma, this is really following this eight qualities of bringing the end to suffering. This path has eight branches: appropriate seeing, thinking, talking, acting, working, trying, recollecting, concentrating. And we are privileged enough today to be able to learn from that wisdom path, integrating it into our mitzvot system, the commandments, strengthening our path, being able to walk in Musar mindfulness is a really positive ethical moral outlook. It goes beyond the simple avoidance of doing wrong. It's a way, it's a vision that we can engage in life in both dispassionate and compassionate ways that help us negotiate the maze of conflicting desire and pain that is often part of the fabric of our human lives. This way of living the mitzvot, supporting each other and the commandments and having appropriate vision, thinking, talking, acting, working, effort, recollecting, gathering of the mind. This is the gift and the path. One day at a time, one foot in front of the other. We will move into 1 minute of silent meditation, and I will ring the bell when we are finished. Give yourself a lovely bow to Hashem, to God, thanking God for our practice, thanking yourself for committing to this radical self-care for this practice, thanking your teacher and our ancestors for bringing this practice to you. Thank you for enabling me and allowing me to. Thank you to the Institute for Holiness for sponsoring this weekly gathering, this awakening Torah, Musar mindfulness, to really guide us all on the path. Thank you so much for today. Here on Sunday, February 4th, here in Israel is now 2:10 p.m. I'm Rabbi Chasya Oriel Steinbauer, the founder and director of the Institute. So grateful to have gathered together as community. Thank you for your support, your sponsorships, and memory of or in honor of someone that enables us to provide this
weekly to you. So grateful.
I had a beautiful quote that I learned today from, I forget if where it was located, maybe on Instagram, somewhere I think on social media, where someone was sharing that they were talking to their 89-year-old Ima, their mother who has dementia. And the mother was explaining how much she loved the child. And she said, she said, I love you. And then she said, I think of you even when I don't know I'm thinking. And for that person listening, the daughter who was listening, that was a form, that was the ultimate answer of what love is. That's the form. This sense of that you're thinking of the person, even when you don't think or know that you're thinking. They're just there, they're embodied, they're within. And that's us in our service. That's us in our emunah, right? Our trust and loyalty, that's through obedience and commitment to God, to each other in this path. That's the gift, is that it's in our bones. Even when we're not thinking or practicing, it's there. And we, God willing, are given the gift and time to bring God's good to others and really be on this path. So thank you again. I look forward to connecting for Yitro soon. Take care.